Prime Minister Scott Morrison says Australia's focus must turn to the technologies of the future as the government looks to broaden the remit of its key clean energy investment bodies. Currently, the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, ARENA as it's known, can only support renewable energy, and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation can only invest in projects which produce less than half the emissions of the grid average, ruling out coal, but not gas. Speaking yesterday, the Prime Minister said there'd been $30 billion in renewables investments since 2017, and with solar and wind now viable on their own, it's the right time to shift the focus.
What we're doing here is removing the constraints to broaden the field of inquiry, of science and research and technology, and not allowing it to be narrow-tracked for political reasons. It's about lower emissions. There are no good and bad emissions reductions. There are only emissions reductions.
That's the Prime Minister Scott Morrison speaking there yesterday. Gillian Broadbent helped establish the Clean Energy Finance Corporation and served as its first chair. She serves on a number of boards currently, including Woolworths and the Macquarie Group. She's the Chancellor of the University of Wollongong. Gillian Broadbent, welcome back to Breakfast.
Thank you, Hamish.
Is it as simple as the Prime Minister puts it, that this is broadening the remit, ensuring that the focus of these projects is not a narrow tract, as he says, by political interests?
Well, it's never been a narrow tract for the CEFC. The purpose was to increase the flow of funds into the emissions reduction sector. And they've invested there. I think they've served the government and the Australian people very well. And if you look at the range of projects they've been in, it's not entirely renewable energy. What they do have in their act is a requirement that 50% of their funds go into renewable energy, but that range of activity of renewable energy can be hybrid with renewable storage. I mean, even if you look at the transactions they've completed, they're very diverse.
When you say storage, are you talking about battery storage or are you talking about CCS
there? Yes, battery storage. No, battery storage. It is specifically excluded in the Act from participating in carbon capture and storage.
And so what do you make of the broadening of this to enable it to include technology that enables carbon capture and storage?
I think it's just a desire to do carbon capture and storage, which is specifically excluded from the Act. And that's the only thing that is excluded.
So you see this
nuclear is excluded.
You see this as a deliberate, targeted move to enable this money, this public money, to be used for CCS.
I assume so, but the whole functioning of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation is to put a commercial filter on transactions so that you can attract private capital there. So for every dollar they've invested, they've attracted $2 from the private sector. And I can't see carbon capture and storage passing that initial commercial filter of the CEFC and also attracting the funds to go with it, which is the purpose of the CEFC. So I really don't understand where carbon capture and storage, why they want to do it and why they want to do it through the CEFC.
If you go to the core of the argument being put by folks like Angus Taylor, there seems to be this argument that there is enough viability now around wind and solar. It's proven, it is working, there is investment in that. Why throw more into supporting it? Why not encourage broader technological development, more research and investment into other potential ways of reducing emissions? Do you buy that argument?
I don't buy that argument because they can already do those things. And if you While the Act says you must invest 50% in renewable energy, you could look at it the other way and say you can't invest more than 50% in renewable energy. And it's the availability of their other activities which cover energy efficiency and low emissions technologies. They're the other 50%. And if they were big enough, the CEFC would be very comfortable reducing the 50%. It's almost holding them back, having to have 50% in renewable energy. They haven't had enough of the other projects to pass the commercial filter and attract other private money into it to enable them to grow above the 50%.
So when the Prime Minister says we can't have these funds constrained by what was put in place 10 years ago, you see things differently.
Well, they're not constrained because the CEFC has $10 billion. It's only ever invested about $6 billion. It's still keeping on investing and funds get repaid and they've got retained earnings of $500 million I mean, they're not restrained in investing in low emissions technologies and energy efficiency. They're continuing to do it, but they tend to be smaller projects than renewable energy, which is why the renewable energy stays at 50% and the others, they're waiting for those projects to emerge and pass the commercial test.
I want to go slightly more specifically to carbon capture and storage. We spoke earlier this morning with Mark McCallum, the Chief Executive of Low Emissions Technology Australia, as it is called. They promote carbon capture and storage as part of reducing emissions. He went into further detail about some of the comments Angus Taylor made to us yesterday around the biggest project in the world around carbon capture and storage being in Australia. But he confirmed that there is no commercial CCS facility for coal yet in this country, but he says it has potential. This is what he says.
It does work. Well, it's working around the world right now. There's 59 instances around the world, whether it's working, it's about to start operation, or is it about to be commissioned. There's 59 examples of this technology working.
He says that this does work, it will work, and it is worth investing in.
Well, it might work and it will work, but it happens to be specifically excluded from the CFC Act. So in Australia, when we don't have a price on carbon, we don't have a great incentive to reduce, we're sort of in, companies are pursuing reductions in emissions of their own initiative, but there's no government policy to specifically encourage that or finance that. So I can't see how carbon capture and storage in this country is going to be economic under our current federal government policies.
Can we place then all of this in the broader policy context? Is a move like this, is a decision to back gas as a transition fuel enough to get Australia's energy policy on track without some of the broader framework that folks like you have been calling for?
No, I don't think so. I think we've got to recognise gas is a transition source of energy, and we've got buildings around Sydney that were built with gas storage and generation to service the building that have never been used because the gas price went up and it wasn't economic to do so. So we can't have a gas policy that'll move around with the gas price. The wonderful thing about renewable energy, it may be intermittent, but at least we know the price is free of the input cost.
But if you listen to someone like Andrew Liveris, who spoke on this program this week, there is a view that it would be crazy not to work with gas, even if it locks us into it, then perhaps longer than necessary. This is a resource that is abundant in Australia, and we should be taking advantage of that. How do you reflect on that?
Well, it's currently abundant because the global price has collapsed, but it's not that abundant. As we all know, there have been inhibiting factors to the development of gas imposed by the state governments. And we didn't have, unlike Western Australia, we had a reserving policy in gas right from when the Northwest Shelf started 30 years ago. We didn't do that on the East Coast. And so the economics of the project were based on a very different assumptions on the East Coast. So if we don't have a reserving policy, and if I go back to Western Australia, they committed to a $2 price for gas for 25 years when we on the East Coast were paying a dollar. We thought that was extraordinarily generous, and yet it enabled them to set a foundation for a gas policy that serviced the state very well.
I want to ask you about universities. You are the Chancellor of the University of Wollongong. I think earlier in the year, your university flagged up to 300 jobs would go as a result of the pandemic. We've seen more news this week about unis slashing hundreds of jobs looking for major savings. Could you offer an observation on the state of the sector today? How bad is it?
Well, I think it's going through a very difficult time, but as far as the University of Wollongong goes, we came to an arrangement with the unions to defer the salary increases, to take a salary cut, and we'll only have voluntary redundancies at this stage that we're planning, and we think we can get through it. But it's actually been a time to bring the university together and think through some of the things we're doing and how we're adapting. So we're pretty, it's tough because we had a significant income, like all the universities, coming from international students. But I think the real danger is we're not investing in the intellectual infrastructure that we need to invest in and the research. And as soon as you start cutting, you will cut into some muscle as well as into the fat, and that really does concern me.
And obviously there's been a lot of noise from the sector about missing out on JobKeeper. On AM this morning, it was revealed that one of America's top universities, New York University, has received a JobKeeper payment at its Sydney campus. Does that strike you as out of step with what is actually available to the university sector?
It is very curious, but the test for private organisations is different to the test of publicly owned institutions. And it's the Treasury making those decisions, not the Department of Education. But, I mean, the reason, I guess, is because the New York University is a very small amount of money. If you introduce job keepers across the whole university sector, the amount would just be so large. But I do think the government has not been as attentive to the pain on the universities as I would have liked them to have been.
Does this scenario, though, with a foreign university receiving it for its Sydney campus, strike you as fair?
No, of course it doesn't. But yeah, it's a very small amount of money. That's probably why they've let it through the gate. But it just highlights how ridiculous it is to support a foreign university and not to support your own publicly owned institutions.
Gillian Broadbent, thank you very much.
Thank you, Hamish.
Gillian Broadbent is a former chair of the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, now the Chancellor of the University of Wollongong. Logging off there promptly at the end of the interview.